aspect is just as important, if not perhaps more important than that physical aspect. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, we don't take care of our health in the physical term, but what it does mean is that, you know, if for some reason, God forbid, we're not very healthy, you know, our, you know, fat, you know, body mass index is not exactly perfect, that isn't as bad as if our spiritual state of health is really bad, and we are unhealthy when it comes to our spiritual life. And so, just as we have a healthy lifestyle, we have a Islamic lifestyle, and that's, you know, what we talk about on A to Z when it comes to Islamic lifestyle. Now, when it comes to spirituality and having a healthy spirituality, of course, this does have an effect on a person's physical body as well. You know, when you feel good, when you feel happy, when you feel spiritually satisfied, this is the manner in which the physical health also improves, and of course, the spiritual health will also improve if we work at it. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how to keep ourselves spiritually healthy. We talked a little bit about how, you know, our body, yes, it does need us to take care of it. But when it comes to our spirit and our soul, which is that which is everlasting, that also requires a lot of attention and it requires work. And, you know, we need to work on our spiritual health. Now, when it comes to our spiritual health, of course, having a good communication and a good, healthy relationship with God, Almighty Allah, is something that is incredibly important. And that's something that we need to work at. This can be done, of course, in a various different ways, whether it is the five daily prayers, which help us to connect to Allah, you know, on a daily basis, five times a day, you know, because we're focusing on God when we are praying and we are doing our wajib obligatory prayers. And really, it's kind of like five times a day we are encouraged, you know, we are requested to come to the court and the presence of the Almighty God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, and spend some time speaking with Him. Now, this speaking with Allah, if we understand what's going on, is what creates a relationship with God. That relationship with Allah is what keeps us spiritually healthy. Of course, the recitation of the Holy Quran with its meaning, this is also very important when it comes to having a healthy soul and a healthy spiritual life or a Islamic lifestyle. So just, you know, very few and short points on how to have a healthy spiritual life in our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Liberal democracies remain shamefully complicit with the Zionist regime despite its ongoing genocide against the Palestinian people. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East I wrote, students of world politics have long understood that when it comes to the strategic interest of leading states, international law is marginalized unless it is useful in waging a propaganda war against adversaries. Indeed, the United Nations was designed in ways that recognize this feature of international political life. Otherwise, giving the winners of the Second World War a right of veto would make no sense. Such an exemption from international law was also evident at the war crimes trials held in Nuremberg and Tokyo after the Second World War, at which only the crimes of the looters were scrutinized for legal accountability and obvious crimes of the victors, such as the indiscriminate bombing of Dresden and the atomic bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were not prosecuted. To this day, for understandable reasons, many in Japan believe the use of weapons of mass destruction against the civilian population of these two cities constituted genocide. Of all the red lines, none was more widely acknowledged than genocide, despite it being often difficult to establish legally in the midst of ethnic conflicts or wartime combat. Genocide is clearly proscribed in international law and by diplomatic pressures, which have mounted as the Zionist regime onslaught has persisted, public outrage has intensified, and the complicity of the West has continued unabated. The pre-Gaza normative authority of the label of genocide was so great that former U.S. President Bill Clinton in 1994 prohibited the use of the word in official discourse, fearing that terming the slaughter in Rwanda a genocide would create irresistible pressures on the U.S. to act to stop the mass killing. Serbia's mid-1990s policies of ethnic cleansing in the Bosnian War were challenged in the International Court of Justice as genocide, but the problems of establishing intent proved too great. Most recently, Myanmar's repression of Rohingya Muslims was widely considered to be genocide, leading to a challenge by Gambia at the ICJ, with the case still pending. For years, the Zionist regime successfully invoked the Holocaust to obscure Israel's own atrocity-laden process of coercive tactics, seeking the maximum dispossession and expulsion of the indigenous majority of Palestinians in the process of establishing the fake regime of Israel in 1948 and occupying East al-Quds, the West Bank, and Gaza since 1967 war. It deflected the hostile global chorus opposing its occupation policies as expressions of anti-Semitism, and even now meets criticism of its practices with the specious argument that it could not be guilty of genocide as it was itself the victim of the largest genocide of all time, a contention recalling W.H. Auden's famous line in a poem, "Those to whom evil is done to do evil in return." How, then, Can we understand this willingness of former Western colonial powers to keep providing various levels of support to the child killer regime of Israel while it carries out, in real time, the most transparent genocide in all of human history? This killing process has shockingly been justified by dehumanizing language employed by the Zionist regime top leaders, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and War Minister Yoav Gallant. For 6 months, the indiscriminate and disproportionate violence has devastated the 2.3 million Palestinian civilians living in Gaza, destroying their already impoverished habitat. Genocide serves as a coercive instrument to induce mass forced expulsion, enacting the settler ethos of leave or die. The Netanyahu coalition government that took office in January 2023 was regarded, even in the West, as the most extremist leadership in all of the Zionist regime's history. What made it extreme, aside from cabinet positions for leaders of Jewish Power Party, Itamar Ben-Gvir, and religious Zionism, Bezalel Smotrich, was the immediate green lighting of settler violence in the occupied West Bank. The erasure of any Palestinian political entity on a map of the new Middle East unfurled by Netanyahu at the UN. And above all, a thinly disguised resolve to complete the Zionist project by incorporating the West Bank and possibly Gaza into Greater Israel. Several months after this government took office came the October 7th Al-Aqsa Storm operation. The Zionist regime onslaught followed, culminating in authoritative international pronouncements suggesting that the Zionist regime was guilty of genocide. The ICJ in January ruled that it was plausible the child-killing regime of Israel had committed acts of genocide in Gaza, with the court voting 15-2 to order the regime to take all possible measures to stop such acts. More conclusively, in March, a meticulous report from the UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories found reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating the Zionist regime's commission of genocide is met. Although Israeli regime's leaders from the outset made no effort to hide their genocidal intentions, and the imagery of nightly TV and social media made this genocide palpable to the eyes and ears of the world, it strangely did not move the world's liberal democracies to adjust their policies. Above all, the US regime held fast. It vetoed a series of ceasefire resolutions at the UN Security Council called the ICJ genocide case meritless and dismissed the analytically impressive genocide report of the distinguished UN Special Rapporteur, Francisca Albanese, as the work of an anti-Semite. It vetoed a series of ceasefire resolutions at the UN Security Council, called the ICJ genocide case meritless, and dismissed the analytically impressive genocide report of the distinguished UN Special Rapporteur, Francisca Albanese, as the work of an anti-Semite. All while pushing for congressional approval of increased military aid, bombs, and munitions to Israel, alongside continued unflagging diplomatic support in international venues. The US regime finally toned down this unconditional posture only after it became clear that it was hurting President Joe Biden's 2024 re-election prospects, and after the furious backlash that followed the attack this month on a World Central Kitchen convoy, which killed 7 aid workers, 6 of whom were Westerners, tasked with bringing food to starving Palestinians. This caused a media uproar in the West so great that it prompted Netanyahu to make a rare apology. This tragic incident also validated the suspicion that the killing of innocent Europeans has much greater political resonance in the West than the killing of thousands of innocent Palestinians, including hospitalized patients and staff. How do we explain this shameful complicity with the Zionist regime and this total rejection of international law in the face of such a transparent and cruel genocide? If the US regime is prepared to exonerate Israel from genocide, the crime of crimes, in this blatant manner, it sends a message to the world that even under the most horrifying circumstances, geopolitical affinities take precedence over law and morality, even for liberal democracies. There are other factors that have contributed to this dark turn in global policy, including the dehumanization of the Palestinian people for decades by assuming the whole population of Gaza is tainted by Hamas. The Orientalist view that Palestinians and all Arab Muslims are somehow subhuman, crude pressures brought in the US by the Israeli lobby, and a lingering guilty conscience in Europe, especially Germany.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
Islamati.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners from all around the world. Welcome back to a new episode of
Youth Station.
I am Beta.
And this is Mustafa.
Yeah. And once again, we have the chance to be next to you at the youth generation, which I think is a pleasure to be, first of all, a candidate at this generation and then have the chance to talk to this generation.
So, the topic that I want to talk about is probably a very relevant topic, and because I'm also studying psychology here in Hausa, so it's much more closer to, you know, sort of my field, and that is about, you know, depression. Depression is a huge problem today, I think.
It is.
You know, among the youth, among even elders, unfortunately, and I'm sure we've all experienced it at some point in our lives. By the way, it's normal to be depressed at some time.
Yeah,
okay? There's like a normal level of depression that we all go through, right? Our moods are never meant to be stable. They go up and down, right? But for some people, that could be much more severe, right?
Yeah.
And I believe you're studying medicine, right?
Yeah.
So you would also have some insight into this. What do you think? What are ways to sort of maybe resolve this or help someone who's depressed?
Actually, depression is seriously common, a common disorder among all the people, specifically youth generation. Mm. And I believe the main reason that youth generation is more depressed than the older generation is that they are more ambitious. You know, they have high expectations that cannot be met sometimes.
Yeah, right? I don't think it's because, I think it's good to have high expectations and ambitions, okay?
No, it's good to have high expectations.
Because those motivate you.
That you can reach. But unfortunately, nowadays, because of the era that we are living in, like social media, like celebrities, for example, everyone wants to be rich. Everyone wants to be that. Everyone wants to be famous.
You know? You're saying like their goals, they're setting themselves such high goals which they may never reach.
Exactly. Right?
That's true. That is, by the way, in psychology, we do study that. Sometimes somebody's, like, it's related to motivation.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes somebody's motivation may fall because they're setting such high expectations, right?
Exactly.
They want to have a balance between like their motivation and what they can reach.
Yeah, and another way that I can approach to this problem is their perfectionism. You know, they are perfectionists. They feel like they have to be the best in every era, in every fold. And it's not like that. Life is not like that. Because they don't have the true understanding and true background of the real life. When they go to universities, when they go to a new job for the first time, they feel like they're confused.
Because
they lack experience, because their parents didn't teach them the principles of surviving in this difficult world. And the thing is, this life is becoming more violent than the past.
Mm.
Okay? We have competitions, we have to kill or be killed, and that's point of view will lead to our depression. Okay.
Well, I had a sort of different angle to this, by the way.
Yeah.
The, you know, one scientific, or I would say chemical reason behind that depression is lack of dopamine, for example.
Yeah, for sure.
So dopamine is a hormone that our brain produces, you know, when we feel pleasure. So example, when you eat chocolate, when you have a good dinner, when you watch a movie, when you have a laugh, you know, your brain produces dopamine. The problem today is that because of, like, let's say your phone, there's like so many things which stimulate dopamine.
Yeah, that you become numb.
Yeah, it becomes numb almost. It doesn't, you don't produce as much. And then you're always looking for the next high or the next thing to produce that dopamine. And that can be a cause of depression, right?
Yeah.
So how to deal with that? We'll come back after the break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So we're back from the break, and I was speaking about, you know, lack of dopamine, you know, that can be a cause of depression.
Yeah.
Because we're always like, for example, whenever I pick up my phone, right, and let's say I turn on social media and someone's liked my photo or whatever, that can produce a little bit of dopamine.
Yeah.
Now I want the next thing. So if I know someone who said the way to deal with it, by the way, is just sit for 1 hour and do nothing.
Do you think you can
do that?
No, I cannot do that. Seriously, I cannot do
that. So if you go into the past, you'll see that let's say our parents or our grandparents, they didn't get bored.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? They say we never get bored.
Yeah,
you know, the reason we get bored is because we're always being stimulated.
Yeah.
The idea behind sitting for 1 hour doing nothing is to not be stimulated, right? And that can help sort of like bring your mood and everything. It's basically a form of meditation even. You know, a lot of people use meditation for these kind of things. So that was my angle on it.
I believe that your angle is specific, and I loved it, by the way. And it's really true, because since my childhood, I saw my grandparents that they were, for example, sitting somewhere reading a book for hours and hours, and they didn't get bored. They felt like amused, and they enjoyed the time. But I was like, I have to do something special. I'm bored. I want to do this. I want to do that. I turned on the TV. I changed the channels, and you know, I was searching for these dopamine releasing triggers, and this is the exact thing that is happening in our adulthood again, that we are searching for these dopamine, and sometimes unfortunately we go for some drugs, even some prescribed drugs like SSRI, which again has its own consequences and its own bad results in our brain.
Yeah. Well, I was going to talk about that. You know, sometimes depression can be very severe, and you know, you should go and see a doctor if that's needed. You know, there are signs and symptoms behind that. That if somebody's sick, then they definitely need medicine for that. But a much better way is to definitely, you know, try to improve your lifestyle. You know, if you're depressed with your lifestyle, then you need to change it, right?
Sport, I believe, is the answer for depression.
Sports, there's so many ways to deal with it, right? You can consult people, you can ask people, sports. You know, the thing about being stimulated, by the way, is that even our parents, like, sometimes I see that parents see their kids that are doing nothing. Like, oh, you're doing nothing. Like, why don't you turn on the TV? Why don't you go and read this? Why don't you... In reality, it's actually very good for them, for kids, to just be bored for a while. Did you know that boredom creates creativity?
Nice.
It's a source of creativity. Because when a child has nothing to do, they will be much more creative in what they're doing, right? They'll come up with new ways of doing things. So one thing is, you know, allow your child to be bored. It's fine. Like, don't, it's not a problem. If they're just sitting there, let them do that.
Yeah.
It's good for them. It's not actually bad for them. And that applies to adults as well. You know, you don't always have to be doing something. allow yourself to just relax and, like, you know, do nothing for a while.
And another thing that I want to mention here is about the times that we're depressed. You know, we feel like we have to cut our connection with everybody else out there, and we have to sit in a room, I don't know, listening to depressed songs, and, I don't know, make our profiles on social medias like black. And these are the things that youth generation do almost when they feel like they're depressed. And this is the wrong way. It's like, for example, whenever you get poisoned, instead of using the antidote to that poison, you are putting an extra dose of poison on that. This is like that. I believe whenever you feel like you're depressed, you have to go out there, you have to go outside, you have to talk to your friends, and this process of communication with people will help you to regain actually your power to rebuild your personality.
You're right. Distraction and distracting yourself from your, like, problems is definitely a technique to sort of deal with this. I had a teacher that, you know, he lost his daughter during COVID, and then he also lost his niece during COVID, right?
So, sad.
And then two or three other people died in his family as well. And he's a therapist, like, he does therapy. And he told us that, you know, there are times when I thought my brain would explode, you know, like, because of sadness. And he said the way I dealt with it is I went to the store to buy potatoes, you know. I went like watered the garden.
Yeah.
I went and played with, like, you know, the kids in the house. So a lot of times we do need other people in our lives to help us and to distract us from whatever that issue or challenge is.
Yeah.
So that is one technique, definitely. You're right. What would you say, you know, as a doctor or maybe just as a person, like, what are other solutions that you can maybe think of?
Yeah. At first, I have to mention that I'm not a doctor.
Oh, sorry.
I have a long way to be a doctor.
You're a doctor candidate. Yeah.
I'm a student. At least I'm a student right now. And the point is, sometimes, you know, when you're under a lot of pressure and you're not organized, it will lead you to depression.
Definitely.
Yeah. And this is one of the reasons that I'm depressed, because I always have a lot of things to do, have a lot of ideas on my mind, but I do nothing about them. I just let them go. And this letting them go will kind of feel like my mind is exploding out of information. And there should be a way for you to sometimes keep your brain empty. Just don't think about anything. You have exam tomorrow. You have, you're under debt. You have, I don't know, you have to do this and that. That's okay. You can relax and not to think about it. Okay? And I believe another method that we can use is to write down your ideas. If you have anything to do, if you have any bad ideas about something, if you had a friend that you didn't like and now you had an argument and now that's the reason that you're upset, then write it down. Sometimes it kind of works.
Definitely. I think, you know, planning your days, you know, planning your life, scheduling your days and your activities definitely helps, you know, for you to sort of stay on track on what you want to do and keep you active and motivated.
Exactly.
Right? There's another dimension to this that I feel like we haven't really touched upon is, you know, asking God for help. Right?
Yeah.
A lot of times, I think people will turn like and say, oh, I'm depressed. What should I do? And what you'll find online is they'll say meditation many times, right? That's something that comes up. And I see a lot of people doing that. And there's nothing really negative about it. But I feel, you know, our prayer, our five daily prayers and our extra prayers, for example, they're our form of meditation.
Yeah.
Right? They're our form of sort of quieting the mind and focusing on, you know, God, for example. And that can greatly help sort of in many, many ways. You know, God is there. He's there to help you, you know. He's saying, like, whenever you're down, call on me.
Yeah, exactly.
He's like, even when you're happy, you have to call on me, right? We have a verse of the Quran where God says, udhuni astajib lakum, right? And this verse, by the way, is not like, it doesn't have any conditions on it. It's not only for Muslims.
Yeah.
It's for everyone. He says, call on me and I will answer you.
This is so beautiful. Okay?
There's no conditions in it.
Yeah.
He doesn't say like you have to be a very pious person. He doesn't say you have to be this. He says anyone who calls upon me, and that doesn't mean that he'll start necessarily, you know, he'll call your phone or he'll answer you. He can answer you many different ways.
Exactly. Okay? And the thing is, we have so many verses in Holy Quran that we created human in difficulty. And there are so many difficulties in your life. There are so many obstacles. Just look at them as a test. You are here because you had the potential to be here, the potential capacity to be here. And believe in yourself. Sometimes you underestimate yourself. Sometimes you feel like you're not powerful enough to defeat all these problems. But you are. You have this power in yourself because Allah Almighty Himself put this power in you and in your soul. So I believe actually strengthening this bond between you and Allah Almighty is the best way, the best remedy towards all these depression stories and so on.
And many times when we're talking about psychology or depression, we're really talking about our soul, right? A lot of those, so you know, if our soul doesn't get its sort of nourishment, its food or what, that's a lot of times when we do become depressed, right? When we're away from God, you know, we feel depressed. So strengthening our spirituality is one way of sort of resolving that. And I was listening to, you know, one of our scholars here. He's a prominent scholar here. And he was saying, you know, we haven't been taught as kids that we have a soul. That, you know, that soul is under development constantly. Right? And it's almost like another body, right? Always have hope that you'll get better.
Exactly. So I hope this episode will be a trigger for you to go and find the happiness of your life and strengthen your bond with Allah Almighty. May Allah bless all of us and put peace in our hearts. So, wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
We'll discuss that, inshallah, in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Latif. Allah, 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 Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah. In the limelight.
The latest killing of the internationals in Gaza was done to serve the same goal, ensuring that no aid distribution mechanism is allowed. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The Zionist regime described its clearly deliberate killing of seven humanitarian aid workers on April 1st as a grave mistake, a tragic event that happens in war. Israel is obviously lying. This entire so-called war, actually genocide, in Gaza has been based on a series of lies, some of which the Zionist regime continues to peddle. For some, in the mainstream media, it took months to accept the obvious fact that the Zionist regime has been lying about the events that led to the war and the military objectives of its constant targeting of hospitals, schools, shelters, and other civilian facilities. So, it was only logical for the Zionist regime to lie about killing the six internationals and their Palestinian driver of the World Central Kitchen, WCK, notwithstanding an event as atrocious
as this. It is implausible for the Zionist regime to start telling the truth now. Luckily, few seem to believe Israel's version regarding WCK or its continued massacres elsewhere in Gaza. The Zionist regime cannot credibly investigate its own failure in Gaza, the U.S.-based NGO said in a statement on April 5th. The issue of targeting these internationals, however, has to be placed within a larger context. The Zionist regime was hardly secretive about its intentions to deny Palestinians even the most basic necessities of survival in Gaza, epitomized in the words of the Zionist regime war minister Yoav Gallant on October 9, saying, "There will be no electricity, no food, no fuel, everything is closed." Initially, this statement, and many others, were understood at the time to be an outcome of the Zionist regime's desire to punish Palestinians for the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood operation by resorting to its typical tactic of collective punishment. Within time, however, and based on statements made by other Israeli regime officials, it became clear that the Zionist regime wanted to ethnically cleanse Palestinians altogether. The Zionist regime's stratagem was immediately rejected by Egypt, Jordan, Arab countries, and eventually by other governments around the world. The Zionist regime, however, persisted. Israeli regime finance minister Bezalel Smotrich said that the voluntary migration of Palestinians in Gaza is the right humanitarian solution. Netanyahu concurred, "Our problem is finding countries that are willing to absorb Gazans, and we are working on it," he claimed. But for ethnic cleansing to take place, several prerequisites had to be fulfilled. 1. The bulk of Gaza's 2.3 million people had to be forced to the south, as close to the Egyptian border as possible. This has been achieved. 2. All aspects of life had to be destroyed throughout Gaza, including all hospitals and clinics. The most obvious examples were grisly massacre of the Al-Ahli Hospital on October 17th, and the bloodbath and eventual total destruction of Gaza's largest medical complex, Ashrafa, on April 1st. When the Zionist regime military pulled out of Ashrafa area, they left behind one of the most tragic scenes in history of modern warfare. Hundreds of bodies were hurriedly buried in mass graves amid charred buildings and indescribable ruins. Limbs of children were sticking out of the dirt, whole families tied and executed together, and other crimes that would take the world a long time to fathom, let alone explain. Still, and nonchalantly so, former Israeli regime Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said that not one civilian was killed in Ashrafa. Again, the Zionist regime is lying. Three most shelters, bakeries, markets, electric grids, and water generators had to, from an Israeli perspective, also be targeted so that the hapless population, especially of northern Gaza, would realize that life there is simply unsustainable. Becoming fully aware of the Zionist regime's ultimate plan of inducing a famine in Gaza, Palestinians fought back. The counter-Palestinian strategy was predicated on ensuring that as many Palestinians as possible remained in northern Gaza, and that those concentrated in Rafah were not pushed into the Sinai Desert. Aside from the ongoing battle between the Zionist regime's army and Palestinian resistance in Gaza, there was another type of war taking place. Israel's push for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and the latter's desire to survive and remain within the Gaza borders. This is precisely why the Zionist regime killed countless Palestinians involved in the work of facilitating life in northern and central Gaza. According to the United Nations, prior to the killing of the six internationals, the Zionist regime had already killed 196 humanitarian aid workers. This number does not include doctors, medical staff, civil defense workers, police chiefs and officers, and anyone contributing to sustaining life in areas that the Zionist regime wanted empty of its inhabitants. Even when, under international pressure, the Zionist regime had allowed limited aid to enter northern Gaza, the Israeli regime military repeatedly killed and wounded Palestinians who desperately gathered in the hope of receiving the life-saving supplies. According to an April 4th report by Euromed Human Rights Monitor, the Zionist regime has killed 563 Palestinians and injured 1,523 when it bombed people waiting for aid at designated spots in northern Gaza, or when it bombed distribution centers and workers responsible for distributing the aid. The Kuwait roundabout area in Gaza City alone witnessed the murder of 256 starving refugees, while 230 others were killed on Al-Rashida Street elsewhere in the city. Israeli regime bombing was not random, as the Zionist regime also targeted and killed 41 police officers who had worked with volunteers from various Gaza clans to help the UN refugee agency UNRWA distribute the aid among the famine-stricken population. Even the clans themselves were targeted in equally merciless bombardments. And similar to the outcome of the attack on the WCK workers, each time the entity responsible for the aid would declare that they would no longer be involved in aid distribution. This is how Gaza's hunger turned into outright famine. The latest killing of the internationals in Gaza was done to serve the same goal, ensuring that no aid distribution mechanism is allowed. Ironically, the involvement of the World Central Kitchen was itself an outcome of a U.S. negotiated agreement that would deny the Gaza authorities and even UNRWA any role in receiving and distributing aid. The Zionist regime must be stopped at any cost, and the Israeli war criminals must be held accountable for one of the greatest genocides in modern history.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود
قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23rd, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. I would like to present a short history of these negotiations. Our negotiations with the Americans are, in fact, different from our negotiations with P5+1. The Americans themselves asked for these negotiations, and their proposals date back to the time of the 10th administration. So the negotiations with the Americans began before the arrival of the current administration. They made a request and chose an intermediary. One of the honorable personalities in the region came to Iran and met with me. He said that the American president had called him, asking him to help. The American president said to him that they want to resolve the nuclear matter with Iran and that they would lift sanctions. Two fundamental points existed in his statements. One was that he said they would recognize Iran as a nuclear power. Second, he said that they would lift sanctions in the course of 6 months. Through that intermediary, he asked us to negotiate with them and to resolve the matter. I said to that honorable intermediary that we do not trust the Americans and their statements. He said, try it once more. And we said, very well, we will try it this time as well. This was how negotiations with the Americans began.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to raise a point for the attention of officials. Of course, everyone should pay attention to it. In global challenges, reason dictates that we take two arenas into consideration. One is the arena of reality and action. So one arena is the arena of reality and action, which is the main arena. In the arena of reality and action, the official who is trying to pursue his activities creates certain assets and resources. This is one arena. Another is the arena of diplomacy and policy. In the arena of diplomacy and policy, this official turns the assets into a concession and national advantage for his country. If one is empty-handed in the first arena, one cannot do anything in the second arena either. You should have an advantage and an asset in the first arena, the arena of action, reality and field work.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saidpur Azad, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Pro-Palestinians in France gathered the day after what was reported to be the first peaceful night in Gaza in 6 months. The reason? The night before, Iran launched a historic missile retaliation against Israel, which prevented Tel Aviv from continuing their attempt at genocide and ethnic cleansing. At the demonstration, there was widespread approval, support, and even gratitude and admiration for Tehran's counterattack against the unprecedented bombing assassination at an embassy.
I'm not an anti-Semite, and as a Muslim, I want us all to live together peacefully, but I see Iran's attack as something good on their part. Iran is the only major country which has had the courage to attack Israel and defend Palestine's innocent civilians. This war can easily stop if Israel can finally realize that they are attempting a genocide.
Those who are occupiers do not have the right to legitimate defense, but Iran does have the right, and they used it to defend Gaza as well. Israel bombs and assassinates people constantly. How can people forget about what Israel has done?
Protesters contrasted Iran's actions with those of the French foreign minister last week. After mentioning the possibility of placing sanctions on Israel over Gaza, he immediately backtracked the next day in front of Parliament.
The French government is quite the accomplice in the genocide that Israel is waging right now. Why aren't there any sanctions despite all these deaths? And when France talks so much about defending human rights, it's simply shameful.
French forces claim to have contributed to Israel's defense. In a major blow to perpetual Israeli hopes of escalating the violence, Washington has already refused to join any potential Israeli attack on Iran. It's uncertain if the cycle of Israeli assassination and Iranian retaliation is now concluded, but Israel has already returned to indiscriminate bombing and mass murder in Gaza, despite 6 months of global outrage, the murder of 34,000 Palestinians, and 76,000 injuries.
Will Israel pursue an even wider war? Will more Arab nations be inspired to join the cause of defending Gaza? What's certain is that many are happy that, for one night at least, the guns aimed at Gaza's civilians finally fell silent. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Pakistanis are showing staunch solidarity with the Iranian retaliatory strikes against the Israeli-occupied territories. Social media platforms overflow with messages of congratulations for Iran's effective response to Israel's atrocities, hailing Iran as a courageous champion of Muslim states willing to confront a Zionist regime, especially following months of atrocities against the Gaza Strip.
We are proud of Iran for taking a stand against Israel's aggression. The Palestinians have been suffering for decades, and it's time someone took action to protect them. Iran's attack shows that they won't tolerate the oppression any longer.
I fully support Iran's decision to strike back against Israel. The Palestinians have been living under siege for decades, and it's high time someone stood up for them. Iran's actions give hope to oppressed people everywhere.
The Pakistani government has echoed both the sentiments of its citizens and voiced grave concerns over escalation of tensions in the Middle East. Islamabad underscored the Israeli blockade of Gaza as a significant factor contributing to the recent wave of tensions, emphasizing the urgent need for international intervention to prevent further escalations in the region.
Iran has done the right thing legally and morally, because Iran has retaliated against Israeli unwarranted aggression and attack on Iranian diplomatic installation in Damascus. And that was a violation of UN charter and international law. So what Iran has done is the right thing. They have responded in kind, and they have taken the battle to the aggressor, and they have hit Israel.
The people of Pakistan emphasized the urgent need for global intervention to halt the escalation of conflict in the region and called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Iran's attack on Israeli-occupied territories has garnered widespread support from Pakistanis, particularly due to their perceived alignment with the plight of people in Gaza. The warm reception of Tehran's operation by the Pakistani nation highlights its desire for a more assertive response to Israel's ongoing atrocities against Palestinians. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
German police have stormed the pro-Palestine conference in the capital Berlin and arrested a number of participants. The Palestine Congress was an important event for the Palestinian solidarity movement in Europe. It was set to be held in the German capital from April 12 to 14. The participants aimed to denounce Israeli apartheid and genocide and Germans' complicity in the genocide of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
We are the Palestine Congress. We accuse the Israeli state of carrying out genocide. And we accuse the German government of supporting, of abetting, of making possible this genocide.
On Friday afternoon, several hundred activists assembled in South Berlin to attend the conference. Soon after the conference started, it was interrupted by the city's police, which had dispatched more than 900 police officers to the area. Outside the conference venue, police officers arrested a man for hoisting a Palestinian flag on a building. The participants inside the conference venue also faced repression. Even the registered journalists were refused entry by the police officers who had been deployed inside the conference hall.
I was in the list, and at the moment as I came, they told me I'm not allowed to enter because there were too many people already inside.
The first part of the conference focused on the history of Palestine.
May marks 76 years since the Palestinian Nakba, 76 years of colonization, of forced exile. However, next month also marks 76 years of resilience, 76 years of a struggle for liberation.
The German police stormed the event during a speech by the Palestinian researcher Salman Abu Sitta, who addressed the conference via video link because he had been not allowed to enter Germany. Police said he was subject to a ban on political activity in the country.
The Palestine Congress was happening. We were watching a video. The police came and shut down the electricity. They didn't give a justification about it. They didn't tell us why. Nevertheless, the police came here, shut it down, said it in the loudspeaker. People are supposed to leave the building right now. You see, they're already taking people.
Chaotic scenes followed. At least two people were arrested inside the hall and several others were interrogated. German Interior Minister Nancy Faeser hailed the police, saying it was good how the police had reacted.
An hour after the start of the conference, German police stormed the conference hall because of a speech on the history of Palestine. In an act of extreme repression, they broke up the conference, declaring it an illegal assembly. However, the Palestine Solidarity Movement vows to continue the conference. Dieter Reinisch from Berlin.
Just one day after France's foreign minister earned praise for saying that sanctions on Israel could be coming over their refusal to allow humanitarian aid to Gaza, he quickly backtracked in a session before Parliament. Many are saying the episode revealed the uniquely powerful sway Zionism has in France.
France, although it has the biggest Jewish community in Europe, has also the most extreme right-wing anti-Palestinian Jewish community in Europe. And this this Jewish community in France has a lot of saying and a lot of control over the media, over the political class. So you have very few people within this community who are protesting what's going on in the Middle East. Not like the United States and Great Britain.
The majority of France's Jews fled from former French colonies in Africa once those countries gained independence in the 1950s and 1960s, and they reportedly brought with them stringent anti-Arab and pro-imperialist views.
In 2019, French Parliament controversially and incorrectly equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism and they are currently reviewing a proposal to fully criminalize anti-Zionism.
They're saying straight, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Therefore, any criticism of Zionism, any criticism of Israel, means you are a criminal because you're an anti-Semite. And so it's killing all debate. Now, all throughout the collective West, but especially in France, the number one threat to freedom of speech is the Zionist movement and the pro-Israeli movement. And I weigh my words because it's very, very dangerous to say something like that in France because you'll find yourself in court.
Since October 7th, support for Hamas and even support for Palestine is off.